This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Decision Points by George W. Bush. Read for you by Ron McClarty. Introduction. In the final years of my presidency, I began to think seriously about writing my memoirs. On the recommendation of Karl Rove, I met with more than a dozen distinguished historians. To a person, they told me I had an obligation to write. They felt it was important that I record my perspective on the presidency in my own words. "Have you ever seen the movie Apollo 13? The historian Jay Wenick asked. "Everyone knows the astronauts make it home in the end, but you're on the edge of your seat wondering how they do it." Nearly all the historians suggested that I read Memoirs by President Ulysses S. Grant, which I did. The book captures his distinctive voice. He uses anecdotes to recreate his experience during the Civil War. I could see why his work had endured. Like Grant, I decided not to write an exhaustive account of my life or presidency. Instead, I have told the story of my time in the White House by focusing on the most important part of the job, making decisions. Each chapter is based on a major decision or a series of related decisions. As a result, the book flows thematically, not in a day-by-day chronology. I do not cover all of the important issues that cross my desk. Many devoted members of my cabinet and staff are mentioned briefly or not at all. I value their service, and I will always be grateful for their contributions. My goals in writing this book are twofold. First, I hope to paint a picture of what it was like to serve as president for 8 consequential years. I believe it will be impossible to reach definitive conclusions about my presidency, or any recent presidency for that matter, for several decades. The passage of time allows passions to cool, results to clarify, and scholars to compare different approaches. My hope is that this book will serve as a resource for anyone studying this period in American history. Second, I write to give readers a perspective on decision-making in a complex environment. Most of the decisions that reach the president's desk are tough calls with strong arguments on both sides. Throughout the book, I describe the options I weighed and the principles I followed. I hope this will give you a better sense of why I made the decisions I did. Perhaps it will even prove useful as you make choices in your own life. Decision Points is based primarily on my recollections. With help from researchers, I have confirmed my account with government documents, contemporaneous notes, personal interviews, news reports, and other sources, some of which remain classified. There were instances in which I had to rely on my memory alone. If there are inaccuracies in this book, the responsibility is mine. I've done my best to write about the decisions I got right, those I got wrong, and what I would do differently if given the chance. Of course, in the presidency, there are no do-overs. You have to do what you believe is right and accept the consequences. I tried to do that every day of my 8 years in office. Serving as your president was the honor of a lifetime, and I appreciate your giving me an opportunity to share my story. Chapter 1. Quitting. It was a simple question. "Can you remember the last day you didn't have a drink?" Laura asked in her calm, soothing voice. She wasn't threatening or nagging. She did expect an answer. My wife is the kind of person who picks her moments. This was one of them. "Of course I can," came my indignant response. Then I thought back over the previous week. I'd had a few beers with the guys on Monday night. On Tuesday, I'd fixed myself my favorite after-dinner drink, B&B, Benedictine and Brandy. I'd had a couple of bourbon and sevens after I put Barbara and Jenna to bed on Wednesday. Thursday and Friday were beer-drinking nights. On Saturday, Laura and I had gone out with friends. I'd had martinis before dinner, beers with dinner, and B&Bs after dinner. Uh-oh. I had failed week one. I went on racking my memory for a single dry day over the past few weeks, then the past month, then longer. I could not remember one. Drinking had become a habit. I have a habitual personality. I smoked cigarettes for about 9 years, starting in college. I quit smoking by dipping snuff. I quit that by chewing long leaf tobacco. Eventually, I got down to cigars. For a while, I tried to rationalize my drinking habit. I was nowhere near as bad as some of the drunks I knew in our hometown of Midland, Texas. I didn't drink during the day or at work. I was in good shape and jogged almost every afternoon, another habit. Over time, I realized I was running not only to stay fit, but also to purge my system of the poisons. Laura's little question provoked some big ones of my own. Did I want to spend time at home with our girls or stay out drinking? Would I rather read in bed with Laura or drink bourbon by myself after the family had gone to sleep? Could I continue to grow closer to the Almighty, or was alcohol becoming my God? I knew the answers, but it was hard to summon the will to make a change. In 1986, Laura and I both turned 40. So did our close friends, Don and Susie Evans. We decided to hold a joint celebration at the Broadmoor Resort in Colorado Springs. We invited our childhood friends, Joe and Jan O'Neill, my brother Neil, and another Midland friend, Penny Sawyer. The official birthday dinner was Saturday night. We had a big meal, accompanied by numerous $60 bottles of Silver Oak wine. There were lots of toasts to our health, to our kids, to the babysitters who were watching the kids back home. We got louder and louder, telling the same stories over and over. At one point, Don and I decided we were so cute we should take our routine from table to table. We shut the place down, paid a colossal bar tab, and went to bed. I awoke the next morning with a mean hangover. As I left for my daily jog, I couldn't remember much of the night before. About halfway through the run, my head started to clear. The cross currents in my life came into focus. For months, I had been praying that God would show me how to better reflect His will. My scripture readings had clarified the nature of temptation and the reality that the love of earthly pleasures could replace the love of God. My problem was not only drinking, it was selfishness. The booze was leading me to put myself ahead of others, especially my family. I loved Laura and the girls too much to let that happen. Faith showed me a way out. I knew I could count on the grace of God to help me change. It would not be easy, but by the end of the run, I had made up my mind I was done drinking. When I got back to the hotel room, I told Laura I would never have another drink. She looked at me like I was still running on alcohol fumes. Then she said, "That's good, George." I knew what she was thinking. I had talked about quitting before and nothing had come of it. What she didn't know was that this time I had changed on the inside, and that would enable me to change my behavior forever. It took about 5 days for the freshness of the decision to wear off. As my memory of the hangover faded, the temptation to drink became intense. My body craved alcohol. I prayed for the strength to fight off my desires. I ran harder and longer as a way to discipline myself. I also ate a lot of chocolate. My body was screaming for sugar. Chocolate was an easy way to feed it. This also gave me another motivation for running, to keep the pounds off. Laura was very supportive. She sensed that I really was going to quit. Whenever I brought up the subject, she urged me to stay with it. Sometimes I talked about drinking again just to hear her encouraging words. My friends helped too, even though most of them did not stop drinking when I was around. At first, it was hard to watch other people enjoy a cocktail or a beer, but being the sober guy helped me realize how mindless I must have sounded when I drank. The more time passed, the more I felt momentum on my side. Not drinking became a habit of its own, one I was glad to keep. Quitting drinking was one of the toughest decisions I have ever made. Without it, none of the others that follow in this book would have been possible. Yet without the experiences of my first 40 years, quitting drinking would not have been possible either. So much of my character, so many of my convictions, took shape during those first 4 decades. My journey included challenges, struggles, and failures. It is testimony to the strength of love, the power of faith, and the truth that people can change. On top of that, it was one interesting ride. I am the first son of George and Barbara Bush. My father wore the uniform in World War II, married his sweetheart as soon as he came home, and quickly started a new family. The story was common to many young couples of their generation. Yet there was always something extraordinary about George H.W. Bush. When Pearl Harbor was attacked, Dad was a high school senior. He had been accepted to Yale. Instead, he enlisted in the Navy on his 18th birthday and became the youngest pilot to earn his wings. Before he shipped off for the Pacific, he fell in love with a beautiful girl named Barbara Pierce. He immediately told friends he would marry her. As a reminder, he painted her name on the side of his plane. One morning in September 1944, Dad was flying a mission over Chichichima, an island occupied by the Japanese. His TBM Avenger was struck by enemy fire, but he kept going, diving at 200 miles per hour, until he had dropped his bombs and hit the target. He shouted for his flight mates to bail out, and then did so himself. Alone in the South Pacific, he swam to the tiny rubber raft that had been his seat cushion. When Dad was rescued by a submarine, he was told he could go home. He rejoined his squadron instead. His tour ended just before Christmas, and on January 6th, 1945, he married Mother at her family church in Rye, New York. After the war, Mother and Dad moved to New Haven so he could attend Yale. He was a fine athlete, a first baseman and captain of the baseball team. Mother came to almost every game, even during the spring of 1946, when she was pregnant with me. Fortunately for her, the stadium included a double-wide seat behind home plate designed for former law professor William Howard Taft. Dad excelled in the classroom, graduating Phi Beta Kappa in just 2.5 years. I attended his commencement in Mother's arms, dozing through much of the ceremony. It wouldn't be the last time I slept through a Yale lecture. Years later, millions of Americans would learn Dad's story. But from the beginning, I knew it by heart. One of my first memories is of sitting on the floor with Mother, looking through scrapbooks. She showed me photos from Dad's pilot training in Corpus Christi, box scores from his games in the College World Series, and a famous picture of him with Babe Ruth on the pitcher's mound at Yale Field. I pored over photos from their wedding, the Navy officer and his smiling young bride. My favorite part of the scrapbook was a piece of rubber from the raft that saved Dad's life in the Pacific. I would bug him to tell stories from the war. He refused to brag, but Mother would. She adored him, and so did I. As I got older, there would be others I looked up to. But the truth is that I never had to search for a role model. I was the son of George Bush. When Dad graduated in 1948, most assumed he would head to Wall Street. After all, his father was a partner at a successful investment house. But Dad wanted to make it on his own. So he and Mother loaded up their red Studebaker and moved west. I've always admired them for taking a risk, and I've always been grateful they settled where they did. One of my greatest inheritances is that I was raised in West Texas. We spent our first year in the blue-collar town of Odessa, where there were few paved streets and frequent dust storms. We lived in a tiny apartment and shared a bathroom with, depending on whom you ask, either one or two prostitutes. Dad's job was on the bottom rung of an oil services company. His duties included sweeping warehouses and painting pump jacks. A fellow worker once asked Dad if he was a college man. Dad told him yes. As a matter of fact, he had gone to Yale. The guy paused a second and replied, "Never heard of it." After a brief stint in California, we moved back to West Texas in 1950. We settled in Midland, the place I picture when I think of growing up. Midland was 20 miles east of Odessa. Native trees did not exist. The ground was flat, dry, and dusty. Beneath it sat a sea of oil. Midland was the capital of the Permian Basin, which accounted for about 20% of America's oil production in the 1950s. The town had an independent, entrepreneurial feel. There was fierce competition, especially in the oil business, but there was also a sense of community. Anybody could make it. Anyone could fail. My friend's parents did all sorts of jobs. One painted houses. One was a surgeon. Another poured cement. About 10 blocks away lived a home builder, Mr. Harold Welch. A quarter century passed before I met him and courted his sweet daughter, Laura Lane. Life in Midland was simple. I rode bikes with pals like Mike Proctor, Joe O'Neill, and Robert McCleskey. We went on Cub Scout trips, and I sold lifesavers door-to-door for charity. My friends and I would play baseball for hours, hitting each other grounders and fly balls until Mother called over the fence in our yard for me to come in for dinner. I was thrilled when Dad came out to play. He was famous for catching pop-ups behind his back, a trick he learned in college. My friends and I tried to emulate him. We ended up with a lot of bruises on our shoulders. One of the proudest moments of my young life came when I was 11 years old. Dad and I were playing catch in the yard. He fired me a fastball, which I snagged with my mitt. "Son, you've arrived," he said with a smile. "I can throw it to you as hard as I want." Those were comfortable, carefree years. The word I'd use now is idyllic. On Friday nights, we cheered on the Bulldogs of Midland High. On Sunday mornings, we went to church. Nobody locked their doors. Years later, when I would speak about the American dream, it was Midland I had in mind. Amid this happy life came a sharp pang of sorrow. In the spring of 1953, my 3-year-old sister Robin was diagnosed with leukemia, a form of cancer that was then virtually untreatable. My parents checked her into Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City. They hoped for a miracle. They also knew that researchers would learn from studying her disease. Mother spent months at Robin's bedside. Dad shuttled back and forth between Texas and the East Coast. I stayed with my parents' friends. When Dad was home, he started getting up early to go to work. I later learned he was going to church at 6:30 every morning to pray for Robin. My parents didn't know how to tell me my sister was dying. They just said she was sick back east. One day, my teacher at Sam Houston Elementary School in Midland asked me and a classmate to carry a record player to another wing of the school. While we were hauling the bulky machine, I was shocked to see Mother and Dad pull up in our family's pea-green Oldsmobile. I could have sworn that I saw Robin's blonde curls in the window. I charged over to the car. Mother hugged me tight. I looked in the back seat. Robin was not there. Mother whispered, "She died." On the short ride home, I saw my parents cry for the first time in my life. Robin's death made me sad, too, in a 7-year-old way. I was sad to lose my sister and future playmate. I was sad because I saw my parents hurting so much. It would be many years before I could understand the difference between my sorrow and the wrenching pain my parents felt from losing their daughter. The period after Robin's death was the beginning of a new closeness between Mother and me. Dad was away a lot on business, and I spent almost all my time at her side, showering her with affection and trying to cheer her up with jokes. One day she heard Mike Proctor knock on the door and ask if I could come out and play. No, I told him, I have to stay with Mother. For a while after Robin's death, I felt like an only child. Brother Jeb, 7 years younger than me, was just a baby. My two youngest brothers, Neil and Marvin, and my sister Doro, arrived later. As I got older, Mother continued to play a big role in my life. She was the Cub Scout den mother who drove us to Carlsbad Caverns, where we walked among the stalactites and stalagmites. As a little league mom, she kept score at every game. She took me to the nearest orthodontist in Big Spring and tried to teach me French in the car. I can still picture us riding through the desert with me repeating, "Ferme la bouche, ouvre la fenêtre." If only Jacques Chirac could have seen me then. Along the way, I picked up a lot of Mother's personality. We have the same sense of humor. We like to needle to show affection, and sometimes to make a point. We both have tempers that can flare rapidly, and we can be blunt, a trait that gets us in trouble from time to time. When I ran for governor of Texas, I told people that I had my daddy's eyes and my mother's mouth. I said it to get a laugh, but it was true. Being the son of George and Barbara Bush came with high expectations, but not the kind many people later assumed. My parents never projected their dreams onto me. If they hoped I would be a great pitcher or political figure or artist, no chance. They never told me about it. Their view of parenting was to offer love and encourage me to chart my own path. They did set boundaries for behavior, and there were times when I crossed them. Mother was the enforcer. She could get hot, and because we had such similar personalities, I knew how to light her fuse. I would smart off, and she would let me have it. If I was smutty, as she put it, I would get my mouth washed out with soap. That happened more than once. Most of the time, I did not try to provoke her. I was a spirited boy, finding my own way, just as she was finding hers as a parent. I'm only half-joking when I say I'm responsible for her white hair. As I got older, I came to see that my parents' love was unconditional. I know because I tested it. I had 2 car wrecks when I was 14, the legal driving age back then. My parents still loved me. I borrowed Dad's car, carelessly charged in reverse, and tore the door off. I poured vodka in the fishbowl and killed my little sister Doro's goldfish. At times I was surly, demanding, and brash. Despite it all, my parents still loved me. Eventually, their patient love affected me. When you know you have unconditional love, there is no point in rebellion and no need to fear failure. I was free to follow my instincts, enjoy my life, and love my parents as much as they loved me. One day, shortly after I learned to drive and while Dad was away on a business trip, Mother called me into her bedroom. There was urgency in her voice. She told me to drive her to the hospital immediately. I asked what was wrong. She said she would tell me in the car. As I pulled out of the driveway, she told me to drive steadily and avoid bumps. Then she said she had just had a miscarriage. I was taken aback. This was a subject I never expected to be discussing with Mother. I also never expected to see the remains of the fetus, which she had saved in a jar to bring to the hospital. I remember thinking, there was a human life, a little brother or sister. Mother checked herself into the hospital and was taken to an exam room. I paced up and down the hallway to steady my nerves. After I passed an older woman several times, she said, "Don't worry, honey. Your wife will be just fine." When I was allowed into Mother's room, the doctor said she would be all right, but she needed to spend the night. I told Mother what the woman had said to me in the hall. She laughed one of her great, strong laughs, and I went home feeling much better. The next day, I went back to the hospital to pick her up. She thanked me for being so careful and responsible. She also asked me not to tell anyone about the miscarriage, which she felt was a private family matter. I respected her wish until she gave me permission to tell the story in this book. What I did for Mother that day was small, but it was a big deal for me. It helped deepen the special bond between us. While I was growing up in Texas, the rest of the Bush family was part of a very different world. When I was about 6 years old, we visited Dad's parents in Greenwich, Connecticut. I was invited to eat dinner with the grown-ups. I had to wear a coat and tie, something I never did in Midland outside of Sunday school. The table was set elegantly. I had never seen so many spoons, forks, and knives all neatly lined up. A woman dressed in black with a white apron served me a weird-looking red soup with a white blob in the middle. I took a little taste. It was terrible. Soon everyone was looking at me, waiting for me to finish this delicacy. Mother had warned me to eat everything without complaining, but she forgot to tell the chef she had raised me on peanut butter and jelly, not borscht. I had heard a lot about my paternal grandparents from Dad. My grandfather, Prescott Bush, was a towering man, 6'4", with a big laugh and a big personality. He was well known in Greenwich as a successful businessman with unquestioned integrity and a longtime moderator of the town assembly. He was also an outstanding golfer who was president of the U.S. Golf Association and once shot 66 in the U.S. Senior Open. In 1950, Gampy, as we all called him, ran for the Senate. He lost by just over 1,000 votes and swore off politics. But 2 years later, Connecticut Republicans persuaded him to try again. This time he won. When I was 10 years old, I went to visit Gampy in Washington. He and my grandmother took me to a gathering at a Georgetown home. As I wandered among the adults, Gampy grabbed my arm. "Georgie," he said, "I want you to meet someone." He led me toward a giant man, the only person in the room as tall as he was. "I've got one of your constituents here," Gampy said to the man. A huge hand swallowed mine. "Pleased to meet you," said Gampy's colleague, Senate Majority Leader Lyndon B. Johnson. My grandfather could be a very stern man. He was from the Children Should Be Seen But Not Heard school, which was foreign to a chatty little wiseacre like me. He doled out discipline quickly and forcefully, as I found out when he chased me around the room after I had pulled the tail of his favorite dog. At the time, I thought he was scary. Years later, I learned that this imposing man had a tender heart. Mother told me how he had comforted her by choosing a beautiful gravesite for Robin in a Greenwich cemetery. When my grandfather died in 1972, he was buried at her side. Dad loved and respected his father. He adored his mom. Dorothy Walker Bush was like an angel. We called her Ganny, and she was possibly the sweetest person I have ever met. I remember her tucking me into bed when I was little, tickling my back as we said nightly prayers. She was humble and taught us never to brag. She lived to see Dad become president and died at age 91, a few weeks after his defeat in 1992. Dad was with her in the final moments. She asked him to read to her from the Bible next to her bed. As he opened it, a bundle of old papers slipped out. They were letters Dad had written her years ago. She had cherished them all her life and wanted them near her at the end. Mother's parents lived in Rye, New York. Her mother, Pauline Robinson Pierce, died when I was 3. She was killed in a car accident when my grandfather Marvin, who was driving, reached down to stop a cup of hot coffee from spilling. The car swerved off the road and hit a stone wall. My little sister was named in my grandmother's memory. I was very fond of Mother's father, Marvin Pierce, known as Monk. He had lettered in 4 sports at Miami University of Ohio, which gave him a mythic aura in my young eyes. He was president of McCall's and a distant relative of President Franklin Pierce. I remember him as a gentle, patient, and humble man. My trips back east taught me two important lessons. First, I could make myself comfortable in just about any environment. Second, I really like living in Texas. Of course, there was one big advantage to being on the East Coast. I could watch Major League Baseball. When I was about 10 years old, my kind Uncle Bucky, Dad's youngest brother, took me to a New York Giants game in the Polo Grounds. I still remember the day I watched my hero, Willie Mays, play the outfield. 5 decades later, I saw Willie again when he served as honorary commissioner for a youth t-ball game on the south lawn of the White House. He was 75 years old, but he still seemed like the say hey kid to me. I told the young ball players that day, I wanted to be the Willie Mays of my generation, but I couldn't hit a curveball. So instead, I ended up being president. In 1959, my family left Midland and moved 550 miles across the state to Houston. Dad was the CEO of a company in the growing field of offshore drilling, and it made sense for him to be close to his rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. Our new house was in a lush, wooded area that was often pelted by rainstorms. This was the exact opposite of Midland, where the only kind of storm you got was a dust storm. I was nervous about the move, but Houston was an exciting city. I learned to play golf, made new friends, and started at a private school called Kincaid. At the time, the differences between Midland and Houston seemed big, but they were nothing compared to what was coming next. One day after school, Mother was waiting at the end of our driveway. I was in the 9th grade, and Mother's never came out to meet the bus, at least mine didn't. She was clearly excited about something. As I got off the bus, she let it out. Congratulations, George. You've been accepted to Andover. This was good news to her. I wasn't so sure. Dad had taken me to see his alma mater, Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts, the previous summer. It sure was different from what I was used to. Most of the dorms were large brick buildings arranged around quads. It looked like a college. I liked Kincaid, but the decision had been made. Andover was a family tradition. I was going. My first challenge was explaining Andover to my friends in Texas. In those days, most Texans who went away to high school had discipline problems. When I told a friend that I was headed to a boarding school in Massachusetts, he had only one question. Bush, what did you do wrong? When I got to Andover in the fall of 1961, I thought he might be onto something. We wore ties to class, to meals, and to the mandatory church services. In the winter months, we might as well have been in Siberia. As a Texan, I identified 4 new seasons, icy snow, fresh snow, melting snow, and gray snow. There were no women, aside from those who worked in the library. Over time, they began to look like movie stars to us. The school was a serious academic challenge. Going to Andover was the hardest thing I did until I ran for president almost 40 years later. I was behind the other students academically and had to study like mad. In my first year, the lights in our dorm rooms went out at 10 o'clock, and many nights I stayed up reading by the hall light that shined under the door. I struggled most in English. For one of my first assignments, I wrote about the sadness of losing my sister Robin. I decided I should come up with a better word than tears. After all, I was on the East Coast and should try to be sophisticated. So I pulled out the Roget's thesaurus Mother had slipped into my luggage and wrote, "Lacerates were flowing down my cheeks." When the paper came back, it had a huge zero on the front. I was stunned and humiliated. I had always made good grades in Texas. This marked my first academic failure. I called my parents and told them I was miserable. They encouraged me to stay. I decided to tough it out. I wasn't a quitter. My social adjustment came faster than my academic adjustment. There was a small knot of fellow Texans at Andover, including a fellow from Fort Worth named Clay Johnson. We spoke the same language and became close friends. Soon, I broadened my circle. For a guy who was interested in people, Andover was good grazing. I discovered that I was a natural organizer. My senior year at Andover, I appointed myself commissioner of our stickball league. I called myself Tweeds Bush, a play on the famous New York political boss. I named a cabinet of aides, including a head umpire and a league psychologist. We devised elaborate rules in a playoff system. There was no wild card. I'm a purist. We also came up with a scheme to print league identification cards, which conveniently could double as fake IDs. The plan was uncovered by school authorities. I was instructed to cease and desist, which I did. In my final act as commissioner, I appointed my successor, my cousin, Kevin Rafferty. That final year at Andover, I had a history teacher named Tom Lyons. He liked to grab our attention by banging one of his crutches on the blackboard. Mr. Lyons had played football at Brown University before he was stricken by polio. He was a powerful example for me. His lectures brought historical figures to life, especially President Franklin Roosevelt. Mr. Lyons loved FDR's politics, and I suspect he found inspiration in Roosevelt's triumph over his illness. Mr. Lyons pushed me hard. He challenged, yet nurtured. He hectored, and he praised. He demanded a lot, and thanks to him, I discovered a lifelong love for history. Decades later, I invited Mr. Lyons to the Oval Office. It was a special moment for me. A student who was making history, standing next to the man who had taught it to him so many years ago. As the days at Andover wound down, it came time to apply to college. My first thought was Yale. After all, I was born there. One time-consuming part of the application was filling out the blue card that asked you to list relatives who were alumni. There was my grandfather and my dad, and all his brothers, and my first cousins. I had to write the names of second cousins on the back of the card. Despite my family ties, I doubted I would be accepted. My grades and test scores were respectable, but behind many in my class. The Andover Dean, G. Grenville Benedict, was a realist. He advised that I get some good insurance, in case Yale didn't work out. I applied to another good school, the University of Texas at Austin, and toured the campus with Dad. I started to picture myself there as part of an honors program called Plan 2. At the mailbox one day, I was stunned to find a thick envelope with a Yale acceptance. Mr. Lyons had written my recommendation, and all I could think was that he must have come up with quite a letter. Clay Johnson opened his admissions letter at the same time. When we agreed to be roommates, the decision was sealed. Leaving Andover was like ridding myself of a straitjacket. My philosophy in college was the old cliché, work hard, play hard. I upheld the former and excelled at the latter. I joined the Delta Kappa Epsilon fraternity, played rugby and intramural sports, took road trips to girls' colleges, and spent a lot of time hanging out with friends. My boisterous spirit carried me away at times. During my senior year, we were at Princeton for a football game. Inspired by the Yale win and more than a little booze, I led a group onto the field to tear down the goalposts. The Princeton faithful were not amused. I was sitting atop the crossbar when a security guard pulled me down. I was then marched the length of the field and put in a police car. Yale friends started rocking the car and shouting, "Free Bush!" Sensing disaster, my friend Roy Austin, a big guy from the island of St. Vincent, who was captain of the Yale soccer team, yelled at the crowd to move. Then he jumped into the car with me. When we made it to the police station, we were told to leave campus and never return. All these years later, I still haven't been back to Princeton. As for Roy, he continued to hone his diplomatic skills. 4 decades later, I appointed him ambassador to Trinidad and Tobago. At Yale, I had no interest in being a campus politician, but occasionally I was exposed to the politics of the campus. The fall of my freshman year, Dad ran for the Senate against a Democrat named Ralph Yarborough. Dad got more votes than any Republican candidate in Texas history. But the national landslide led by President Johnson was too much to overcome. Shortly after the election, I introduced myself to the Yale chaplain, William Sloan Coffin. He knew Dad from their time together at Yale, and I thought he might offer a word of comfort. Instead, he told me that my father had been beaten by a better man. His words were a harsh blow for an 18-year-old kid. When the story was reported in the newspapers more than 30 years later, Coffin sent me a letter saying he was sorry for the remark, if he had made it. I accepted his apology, but his self-righteous attitude was a foretaste of the vitriol that would emanate from many college professors during my presidency. Yale was a place where I felt free to discover and follow my passions. My wide range of course selections included astronomy, city planning, prehistoric archaeology, masterpieces of Spanish literature, and, still one of my favorites, Japanese haiku. I also took a political science course, mass communication, which focused on the content and impact of the mass media. I ended up with a 70, which might explain my shaky relations with the media over the years. My passion was history, which became my major. I enjoyed listening to the lectures of professors like John Morton Blum, Gaddis Smith, and Henry Turner. One of my first history courses focused on the French Revolution. "My business is the past," Professor Stanley Mellon liked to say. He gave gripping accounts of the tennis court oath, the terror of Robespierre, the rise of Napoleon. I was appalled by the way the ideas that inspired the revolution were cast aside when all power was concentrated in the hands of a few. One of my most memorable courses was History of the Soviet Union, taught by an East German lecturer named Wolfgang Leonhard. Mr. Leonhard had fled Nazi Germany as a boy and grown up in the Soviet Union, where his mother was arrested during Stalin's purges. He was groomed to be a communist official, but he defected to the West. In his thick German accent, he described the show trials, mass arrests, and widespread deprivations. After listening to him, I never thought about the Soviet Union or the communist movement the same way. The class was an introduction to the struggle between tyranny and freedom, a battle that has held my attention for the rest of my life. My senior year, I took a course called The History and Practice of American Oratory, taught by Professor Roland G. Osterweis. We read famous American speeches from the fiery sermons of colonial preacher Jonathan Edwards to President Roosevelt's Day of Infamy address after Pearl Harbor. I was struck by the power of words to shape history. I wrote a paper analyzing Georgia journalist Henry W. Grady's speech on the New South and drafted 4 minutes of remarks nominating Red Sox star Carl Yastrzemski for mayor of Boston. Professor Osterweis taught us how to structure a speech: introduction, three main points, peroration, and conclusion. I've remembered his model all my life, which, as it turned out, has included quite a few speeches. None of this is to suggest I was a particularly noteworthy student. I think it's fair to say I got more out of the experience than my professors did. John Morton Blum was once asked what he remembered about his famous student George W. Bush. He replied, "I haven't the foggiest recollection of him, but I remember Professor Blum." Graduation came in a tumultuous time. Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated in April of my senior year. Race riots followed in Chicago and Washington, D.C. Then, a few days before commencement, my friends and I were driving back from a trip to upstate New York when we heard on the radio that Bobby Kennedy had been killed. Nobody in the car said a word. There was a sense that everything was coming unglued. For most of our time at Yale, civil rights dominated the campus discussion. By our senior year, another issue weighed on our minds. The war in Vietnam was escalating, and President Johnson had instituted a draft. We had two options: join the military or find a way to escape the draft. My decision was easy. I was going to serve. I was raised by a dad who had sacrificed for his country. I would have been ashamed to avoid duty. My attitude toward the war was skeptical, but accepting. I was skeptical of the strategy and the people in the Johnson administration executing it. But I accepted the stated goal of the war: to stop the spread of communism. One day in the fall of my senior year, I walked by a recruiting station with a poster of a jet pilot in the window. Flying planes would be an exciting way to serve. I checked in with the recruiter and picked up an application. When I went home for Christmas, I told my parents about my interest in the Air Force. Dad referred me to a man named Sid Ager, a former pilot who was well connected in the aviation community. He suggested that I consider joining the Texas Air National Guard, which had pilot slots available. Unlike members of the regular guard, pilots were required to complete a year of training, 6 months of specialized instruction, and then regular flying to keep up their status. Serving as a guard pilot appealed to me. I would learn a new skill. If called, I would fly in combat. If not, I would have flexibility to do other things. At that point in my life, I was not looking for a career. I viewed my first decade after college as a time to explore. I didn't want anchors to hold me down. If something caught my attention, I would try it. If not, I would move on. This was the approach I had taken to summer jobs. In 1963, I worked on a cattle ranch in Arizona. The foreman was a grizzled fellow named Thurman. He had a saying about well-educated folks he knew: book smart, sidewalk stupid. I was determined not to let that phrase apply to me. I spent other summers working on an offshore oil rig in Louisiana, behind the trading desk of a stock brokerage house, and as a sporting goods salesman at a Sears Roebuck. I met some fascinating characters along the way: cowboys and Cajuns, roughnecks and roustabouts. I've always felt I received two educations in those years, one from fine schools and one from solid people. In the fall of 1968, I reported to Moody Air Force Base in Georgia for pilot training. We started with about 100 trainees and graduated with about 50. The washouts were early and frequent. I remember one guy from New York who came back from his first flight in a Cessna 172 looking as green as his flight suit, except for the part on which he had spilled his lunch. My early experiences in the year were only slightly better. My instructor could smell insecurity, and he did not believe in quiet counseling. On one of my first flights, he suddenly grabbed the yoke, pulled back as hard as he could, and stalled the aircraft. The nose went up, and the plane shuddered. He then shoved the stick forward, and down went the nose. The plane recovered. The trainer had shown me my first stall recovery maneuver. He looked at me and said, "Boy, if you want to be a pilot, you must control this machine and not let it control you." I took his advice seriously. I mastered the basics of flying, including loops, barrel rolls, and instruments. When Dad came to pin on my wings, I felt a tremendous sense of accomplishment. After flight school, I moved to Houston, where I learned to fly a fighter jet called the F-102 at Ellington Air Force Base. The F-102 was a single-seat, single-engine air interceptor. When you taxied to the end of the runway, put the throttle in afterburner, and felt the engine kick in, it didn't matter who you were or where you came from. You had better pay attention to the moment. I loved flying, but by 1972 I was getting restless. I was logging my flight hours during the evening or on weekends, and working during the days at an agribusiness. My duties at the office included conducting a study of the mushroom industry in Pennsylvania and visiting plant nurseries that the company had acquired. It was not exactly captivating work. One day, I got a call from my friend Jimmy Allison, a Midland political operative who had run Dad's successful campaign for the U.S. House of Representatives in 1966. He told me about an opportunity on Red Blunt's campaign for the U.S. Senate in Alabama. It sounded interesting, and I was ready to move. My commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Killian, approved my transfer to Alabama on the understanding that I would put in my required hours there. I informed the Alabama Guard commanders that I would have to miss several meetings during the campaign. They told me I could make them up after the election, which I did. I didn't think much about it for another few decades. Unfortunately, the record-keeping was shoddy, and the documentation of my attendance was not clear. When I entered politics, opponents used the gaps in the system to claim I had not fulfilled my duty. In the late 1990s, I asked a trusted aide, Dan Bartlett, to dig through my records. They showed that I had fulfilled my responsibilities. In 2004, Dan discovered some dental records proving I had been examined at Danley Air National Guard Base in Montgomery, Alabama, during the time critics alleged I was absent. If my teeth were at the base, he wisecracked to the press, they could be pretty sure the rest of my body was too. I thought the issue was behind us. But as I was landing in Marine One on the South Lawn late one evening in September 2004, I saw Dan's silhouette in the diplomatic reception room. As a general rule, when a senior advisor is waiting to meet the president's chopper, it is not to deliver good news. Dan handed me a piece of paper. It was a typewritten memo on National Guard stationery alleging that I had not performed up to standards in 1972. It was signed by my old commander, Jerry Killian. Dan told me CBS newsman Dan Rather was going to run a bombshell report on 60 Minutes based on the document. Bartlett asked if I remembered the memo. I told him I had no recollection of it and asked him to check it out. The next morning, Dan walked into the Oval Office looking relieved. He told me there were indications that the document had been forged. The typeface came from a modern computer font that didn't exist in the early 1970s. Within a few days, the evidence was conclusive. The memo was phony. I was amazed and disgusted. Dan Rather had aired a report influencing a presidential election based on a fake document. Before long, he was out of a job. So was his producer. After years of false allegations, the guard questions finally began to abate. I was always proud of my time in the guard. I learned a lot, made lifelong friends, and was honored to wear our country's uniform. I admire and respect those who deployed to Vietnam. Nearly 60,000 of them never came home. My service was nothing compared to theirs. In 1970, Dad decided to run for the Senate again. We felt good about his chances in a rematch against Ralph Yarborough. But Senator Yarborough had become so unpopular that he lost his primary to Lloyd Benson, a conservative Democrat. Dad ran a good race, but again came up short. The lesson was that it was still very tough to get elected as a Republican in Texas. Soon there was another lesson. Defeat, while painful, is not always the end. Shortly after the 1970 election, President Richard Nixon made Dad ambassador to the United Nations. Then in 1973, President Nixon asked Dad to head the Republican National Committee. It turned out to be a valuable lesson in crisis management when Dad guided the party through the Watergate scandal. Mother and Dad were in the White House the day President Nixon resigned and Gerald Ford took the oath of office. Soon after, President Ford offered Dad his pick of ambassadorships in London or Paris, traditionally the two most coveted diplomatic posts. Dad told him he would rather go to China, and he and Mother spent 14 fascinating months in Beijing. They came home and President Ford asked Dad to head the Central Intelligence Agency. Not a bad run for a twice-defeated Senate candidate. And, of course, it didn't end there. I admired Dad's accomplishments. Since my teenage years, I had followed his path closely. Andover and Yale, then service as a military pilot. As I got older, I had an important realization. Nobody was asking me to match Dad's record, and I didn't need to try. We were in completely different situations. By age 30, he had fought in a war, married, fathered three children, and lost one of them to cancer. When I left the Guard in my late 20s, I had no serious responsibilities. I was spontaneous and curious, searching for adventure. My goal was to establish my own identity and make my own way. For their part, my parents recognized my buoyant spirit and did not dampen it. They did tell me when I got out of line. One of the sternest conversations I ever had with Dad came when I was 20 years old. I was home from college for the summer and roustabouting on an oil rig for Circle Drilling out of Lake Charles, Louisiana. I worked 1 week on, 1 week off. After a lot of hot, hard work, I decided to blow off my last week to spend time with my girlfriend in Houston. Dad called me into his office. I told him nonchalantly that I had decided to quit my job a week early. He told me the company had hired me in good faith, and I had agreed to work until a certain date. I had a contract, and I had violated it. I sat there feeling worse and worse. When he ended with the words, "Son, I am disappointed," I was ashamed. A few hours later, the phone rang at the house. It was Dad. I was worried I was going to get another lecture. Instead, he asked, "What are you doing tonight, George?" He told me he had tickets to the Houston Astros game, and he invited me and my girlfriend. I immediately accepted. The experience reinforced the importance of honoring my word, and it showed me the depth of my father's love. Dad was serious when needed, but our household was full of laughter. Dad loved to tell jokes to us kids. "Have you heard the one about the airplane? Never mind, it's over your head." He came up with nicknames for family and friends. At one point, he called me Junie, short for Junior. My brother Neil was known as Whitey, which morphed into Whitney, because of his blonde hair. Dad's dear friend James Baker became Bake. In his crowning achievement, Dad dubbed Mother the Silver Fox. Dad's wonderful sense of humor continued throughout his life. When he was president, he created the Scowcroft Award, named for National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, for staff members who fell asleep during meetings. Now in his 80s, he shares jokes via email, rating each on a scale of 1 through 10. A few years ago, Dad was recovering from hip surgery at the Mayo Clinic. When the nurse came to check on him, he asked, "Are my testicles black?" She was taken aback. "Excuse me, Mr. President?" He repeated his question. "Are my testicles black?" As she reached for the sheet, he quipped, "I said, are my test results back?" His medical team roared with laughter. Over the years, there have been a lot of speculation about my relationship with Dad. I suppose that's natural for the first father and son presidents in 172 years. The simple truth is that I adore him. Throughout my life, I have respected him, admired him, and been grateful for his love. There is an infamous story about me driving home late one night, running over the neighbor's trash can, and then smarting off to Dad. When some people picture that scene, they envision two presidents locked in some epic psychological showdown. In reality, I was a boozy kid, and he was an understandably irritated father. We didn't think much about it until it came up in the newspapers 20 years later. Moments like these are a reminder that I am not just my father's son. I have a feisty and irreverent streak courtesy of Barbara Bush. Sometimes I went out of my way to demonstrate my independence, but I never stopped loving my family. I think they understood that, even when I got on their nerves. I finally saw things from my parents' perspective when I had children of my own. My daughter Jenna could be sassy and sharp, just like me. When I was running for governor in 1994, I accidentally shot a killdeer a protected songbird on the first day of dove hunting season. The blunder produced headlines, but quickly faded. A few weeks before the election, Laura and I campaigned with the girls at the Texas State Fair in Dallas. 12-year-old Jenna won a stuffed bird as a prize at a carnival game. With the TV cameras rolling, she held the plush animal in the air. "Look, Dad," she said, giggling. "It's a killdeer." In the fall of 1972, I went to visit my grandmother in Florida. My college friend Mike Brooks was in the area, and we played golf. Mike had just graduated from Harvard Business School. He told me I should consider going there. To make sure I got the message, he mailed me an application. I was intrigued enough to fill it out. A few months later, I was accepted. I wasn't sure I wanted to go back to school or to the East Coast. I shared my doubts with my brother Jeb. I didn't know Jeb very well when he was growing up. He was only 8 when I moved out for boarding school. But we grew closer as we got older. Jeb was always more serious-minded than I was. He was intelligent, focused, and driven in every way. He learned to speak fluent Spanish, majored in Latin American affairs, and graduated Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Texas. During his senior year in high school, he lived in Mexico as part of a student exchange program. There, he met a beautiful woman named Columba Garnica. They were both young, but it was obvious Jeb was in love. When we went to the Astrodome together, I'd watch the ball game, and he'd write letters to Kalu. They got married 2 weeks after his 21st birthday. One night, Jeb and I were having dinner with Dad at a restaurant in Houston. I was working at a mentoring program in Houston's poverty-stricken Third Ward, and Dad and I were having a discussion about my future. Jeb blurted out, "George got into Harvard." After some thought, Dad said, "Son, you ought to seriously consider going. It would be a good way to broaden your horizons." That was all he said, but he got me thinking. Broadening horizons was exactly what I was trying to do during those years. It was another way of saying, push yourself to realize your God-given talents. For the second time in my life, I made the move from Houston to Massachusetts. The cab driver pulled up to the Harvard campus and welcomed me to the West Point of capitalism. I had gone to Andover by expectation and Yale by tradition. I was at Harvard by choice. There I learned the mechanics of finance, accounting, and economics. I came away with a better understanding of management, particularly the importance of setting clear goals for an organization, delegating tasks, and holding people to account. I also gained the confidence to pursue my entrepreneurial urge. The lessons of Harvard Business School were reinforced by an unlikely source, a trip to visit mother and dad in China after graduation. The contrast was vivid. I'd gone from the West Point of capitalism to the eastern outpost of communism, from a republic of individual choice to a country where people all wore the same gray clothes.